Hello and welcome, everybody. You're listening to Mushing Radio here on KVRF 89.7 in the Mattsu Valley. RadioFreePalmer.org is our live streaming site, and you can find all of our episodes over on DogWorksRadio.com. You can also follow us on all of the social media sites. Just search for that Dog Works Radio. And today we are joined by a special guest. He is the director and producer of Dog Power, the movie, dogpowermovie.com. His name is Cale. Cale, how's it going?
Great to be with you all today.
Well, can you do us a favor and introduce yourself? Tell us who you are and what you're all about.
Sure, and I do have quite a few friends right in the area there. I've been a wildland firefighter in Alaska for the past 9 years, and I do information officer now. I used to be a paramedic on the front lines up in the interior fires, and some big ones like the Sockeye and the Funny River and the rail belt over the years. You get to know a lot of the interior villagers and all the locals, so a lot of friends out there, saying hello to all them. And I do spend quite a bit of the year when I can in Colorado working on my properties there. That's where I used to train and race at 10,000 feet. It didn't give me much of a competitive edge. I thought training up there would really help me out at my races, but I still kind of got my butt kicked at the World Championships. And that's a lot of what Dog Power Movie is about. It's the story of getting into the dogs, not knowing much, not being around a big mushing community, and then trying to figure it out on my own. And 6 years later, I produced a movie to try to get the world inspired to understand both what we do and, more importantly, that common bond that we share with our dogs, and that they can have that too, that is very accessible, especially in the one and two dog world.
It is. And, you know, as you mentioned in your trailer, I have not seen the movie yet. I'm looking forward to getting a copy here after the show. I took a look at your website today, and first thing I got to say, it's a beautifully produced trailer, excellent cinematography there. And, you know, of course, being around sled dogs and everybody that's listening, that bond that we have with our dogs, I am sure it speaks loud and clear on that movie. So you had mentioned that, you know, you're sort of spread out all over the place, and you made this movie to sort of capture that story. How long have you been involved with dogs? How did you get your start in that? And, you know, how did you get kind of reined into this crazy lifestyle that we have?
Sure, great question. Back in the 90s in Colorado, I had always wanted to have a good dog in my life, and I adopted a Siberian Husky from a friend, and he was actually the best backcountry skier around. I always hang out in the high country. That's been my passion, is powder skiing and avalanche country. And, you know, Siberians are indestructible. They can handle any temperature, any day, any amount of snow. And it wasn't until about 2009 that I saw a neighbor bike jor through my yard in Colorado. And I thought, my God, I definitely want to do that. I hadn't really been around that many sled dogs. I'd been out trying to make a living on the fire line and back and forth and just trying to scrape together enough to make a house happen. I've been living outside from the time I graduated college in 1994 to when I built my first house in 2010. So my plate was already kind of full, just living life. And once I got in that saw that bike tour go cruising through my yard, I thought, man, I definitely want to experience that power. And that kind of led me down the road of thinking, well, I need to get a really, really good dog. And I just didn't have many mentors, didn't know many folks. So I went on the internet and went ahead and bought a purebred Siberian, ironically, from Tennessee, which is kind of funny because looking back on it, of course, you'd never do that. You'd just ask a neighbor up in Alaska or Willow or somebody, you know, kick you down a puppy or adopt an older dog and start that way. But I didn't. And I think that's the common story in the world, is people don't have the access that you all have in the Mattsu and the Willow area and the Fairbanks area to all these incredible mushers and the incredible dogs and the adoptable dogs. And when you're out there in the world, you're left to yourself. You just don't have much information. So, of course, I went out with my Siberian Husky, got her at 8 weeks old and trained her up, thought she'd be a world champion, really kind of had that in my mind. And we went out there, and of course, we were humiliated. We were going real slow. She wasn't that climate adapted, and she wasn't really made for racing anyway. Her conformity wasn't there. She was a show dog. And the joke was on me, and I got that right away. I realized, okay, I need to find out who out there really has the fast dog. What is the story that people haven't shared with me? And so that's how I got into it. And I got a couple Ella sounds from Eagle up in, you know, I used to go up to Fairbanks and work at Fort Wainwright a lot, and so I'd be able to go down and visit his kennel. And didn't know many mushers in Alaska at that time, and Eagle's name came up in the 48 because, of course, his name was well-known down there. for all the Rendezvous wins and the ONAC wins and beating George Atla in the ONAC record books. And so I went with the name recognition and got a couple of LS Hounds, raced them at a world championship, and got my butt kicked again. Because, of course, I'm a one- and two-dog ski drawer. I need a big German Shepherd pointer. I need a big gracer. But nobody had told me that. And that's how I got into it. I realized right away I needed to tell the story. And I've been traveling around with this movie now for 6 months, audiences all over the world. And every single person in that audience, almost hands down, comes up to me afterwards and says, God, I just did not know that about sled dogs. I thought everybody did the Iditarod, and I thought everybody had Huskies.
Right. You know, Cale, your story sounds very similar to mine. I started in the early 90s. I started with a couple of Siberian Huskies from the mountains in Georgia. And here I am, I don't know, 20 or 30 years later, and I'm still chasing that crazy Iditarod dream. I still have a few Siberians just because I love the breed so much. But our kennel now is primarily the Alaskans. And of course, we have dabbled a little bit over the years in sprint mushing, and we still do here in the Mattsu Valley. We head over to Chugiak and Aurora Dog Track, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. But we're always last. We're always getting our butts beat by those fast Euro hounds. You know, I've raced against Egil a few times and, you know, all of those folks around here. But, you know, your movie, Dog Power, is focusing primarily on those sprint dogs. And, of course, we talk a lot here on Mushing Radio just because it's my background, more of a distance dog, you know, sort of format. So this is tailored to the other side of mushing that not a lot of folks know about. As you mentioned, you know, everybody's heard of Iditarod. You know, many people have heard of the Quest. We've seen all the mushing movies, but there hasn't been a lot of coverage or play, so to speak, in kind of a general audience speaking in the sprint world. And I think you're capturing that with your Dog Power movie. What are folks telling you about it? I know that they're excited. It's a magnificent sport to watch because, and number one, it's much shorter. You can go to a race and see the start and the finish in an afternoon versus, maybe a week or two with the longer races. What has been the feedback from the audiences? Because I'm sure everybody thinks, hey, I can do that with my dog that's sitting on the couch.
Exactly. That's really the goal of the movie. The goal of the movie is to build an understanding of the love of going forward with your dog, whether you're 70 years old and want to do canicross in Scotland, or if you live somewhere in South America and you've just seen the Iditarod on the National Geographic Channel your whole life, and then you see Dog Power and you say, oh my God, I didn't know I could bike tour, I didn't know I could canicross, I didn't know I could get in this sport, start training, having that relationship, and then understand that these big kennels actually serve a really important purpose because the big kennels are kind of under fire. And we know that from the documentary Sled Dogs that came out.
Right.
I didn't know that she was producing that. I didn't know that crew was out there lying and gaining access illegally to races and to kennels. Even near me, I live right near Kablunik in Snowmass, Colorado. I know they've had issues over the years. But they were in there, you know, twisting the story up, trying to get everybody to turn on big kennels and say, we shouldn't have dogs on tethers. We shouldn't have big kennels. And when they see Dog Power, what they get is a real love story. And that love transfers through to the big kennels because once you get it, once you get that the sport is not about capturing a dog and making them work for you, when you see our footage, and it works really hard. We had three cameramen with drones all over the world. We filmed in Alaska. We filmed in Canada. We filmed in Germany, Sweden, Norway, and the United States, lower 48 as well. And we capture moments where there's just no question about it that dogs are having an awesome time hauling ass. And we get Arlie Reynolds in there giving you the VO2 max, letting people know in the physiological sense that the dogs are the greatest athletes alive, not just sprint dogs. I think he really did that research actually to show that the distance dogs had the highest VO2 max in the world. And then he tested his own dog, Guts, his own lead dog, after he was chasing the ONAC title for a long time there, finally won in 2013. And when he got his own dogs on there, he realized, my God, the sprint dogs have this too. When audiences connect with that, when they really, really see what's going on, they're much more likely to say, okay, these big kennels must have this love in them too. And we know that the big kennels have to keep going. We need them. The big races, school kids all across the country follow them. People all around the world have that as the beginning of their dream. I want to have a Husky. I want to go on snow. I want to travel to Alaska. I want to travel to somewhere special and experience dogs. It's part of that whole like passion of just wanting to explore everything in life. And so the feedback we get for our movie is a lot of, wow, thanks for capturing that. Thanks for setting it straight and letting us know and bringing us into people's houses, because we'll definitely show you in Dog Power that you travel to Egil's new house in Sweden. You travel to Lena Boysen Hillsted's house in Norway. You hear about how some of these breeds came about. And there's no question you see that we treat our dogs like family members.
And that we do for sure. We're talking to Cale Casey today. He's calling in from Hawaii, waiting for a flight. He just recently presented at the film festival there. So that's pretty exciting to be able to travel over to the islands there to show those folks over there what we're all about as mushers. But my question to you, Cale, how in the world does a firefighter slash musher become a filmmaker? And how do you do that? Where does that fit in on the resume?
Right. You know, that's a great question. I started going to mountain film festivals in the late 90s in Telluride, Colorado. And you see everything there. You see the climbing movies, the surf movies, the incredible movies. I was a volunteer like I always am and got involved deeply and thought, you know what, there's a story inside of me that I need to tell someday. And I just didn't necessarily know what that story was. So when I did get into dogs, I've always had cameras around. My dad only had one eye his whole life, so he always made sure that we were camera savvy. Technology's changed a lot since he passed away years ago, but I picked up a $3,000 video camera that my friend recommended can handle the climate anywhere I went, and I just started filming, saying, I don't know how it's going to come about. I don't know how I'm going to learn to edit, but I know I need to start getting the footage now. So most people who know me from 2013 remember that I was that guy with the tripod at every start and finish, and interviewing folks and always with the GoPro on. And what really happened, Robert, was I kind of realized, okay, if I don't get some help, I've got too much else going on. Fire season can last 100 days. You can get pushed right into October, November these days. And I realized if I don't hire somebody, I'm not going to get this project out to the public where we needed it. And so I went to my neighbor and said, hey, I can't promise you much, but I can give you $1,000 today. I can give you a couple more before we go to the World Championship, a couple after. If you agree to come along with me, I'll pay your way. We'll eat bread and ham and drink water. We'll sleep in a youth hostel. We'll get all the great footage from 2015 World Championship. We'll come home and we'll start cutting something. And that's exactly what happened. And my neighbor, Jordan Chevenet, is a fantastic filmmaker. He went a leap of faith. He's just outgoing. All the dog people loved him all over Europe. And that's really what it took, was bringing on some expertise. And, you know, these things can't be done alone, just like a big dog team. You can't do it all by yourself. And bringing in a writer helped us get the storyline where it's compelling enough that you can watch it over and over again. And the success is that Banff World Tour, which is the biggest mountain film tour in the world, they go to 40 countries, they do up to 10,000 screenings, they selected it in their number one or number two slot out of 40 films.
Wow.
To go on tour, because they realize that people have seen a million great climbing movies and surfing movies and kayaking movies and all that stuff, but people hadn't seen this sprint side, they hadn't seen, you know, dynamic kart racing with drone shots coming around the track in Bristol, Canada, one of the greatest dry land courses in the world. They hadn't seen the hills in Germany where people have to really run uphill with their sprint team and show that this is not just dogs pulling a lazy musher. And people do have a wonder, hey, is this all the dogs doing the work, or is this humans too? And we all know that it's a one hell of a job for both parties. If you want to be a champion, you want to win, everybody's got to be in shape. But there's no question in sprint mushing, when you see a canicross runner flailing down the trail because their dog wants to run 30 miles an hour, that they have to be in shape, that they have to be able to keep up with this kind of thing. And that gets the athletes out there inspired. That gets the people who want to be fit and want to live an active lifestyle inspired. And that was the whole goal, that they know what we're doing and they can start getting involved.
Right. You know, Cale, I am a student of behind-the-scenes stuff. I love finding out about that sort of stuff. And you had mentioned the GoPros and the drones, and I think that that technology is really changing how our sport is shown to the public. You know, before it was the old, the old digital cameras, the handhelds and whatnot, mm-hmm. that weren't very good. And, of course, you could only see the start or the finish, and, you know, if you had a plane or whatever on Iditarod, you could capture that. But my question to you is, how did you utilize that new technology, drones in particular, And was it a game changer for your film to be able to use this new stuff? And my second question to you, something I've been trying to figure out for a long time, is how we can attach a GoPro or something to a lead dog to get that view from, you know, from the head of the dog without it bouncing all over the place, using a gimbal or something like that. What have you found that works, if you have?
Okay, I'll answer the first part first. We didn't have the money to bring a drone with us to Germany, and honestly, we didn't know the rules. We didn't know if somebody was going to arrest us for not having the right permit at the World Championship. So we were, Jordan and I were running around the track for 14 days, filming like crazy. And on day 10, the crowd there, 6,000 people in the Black Forest of Germany, lining the starts and the finishes, 10, 20 deep. We heard a drone flying overhead. And I remember distinctly being at the finish line, abandoning my camera on a tripod, jumping through the crowd to go look for the guy who was holding the iPad, operating that drone, saying, I need to talk to whoever that is, knowing that that was the most important footage I was probably going to have of the entire event to get that perspective of the crowd and all that. And that ended up being a 22-year-old kid named Max, and he's from the local area. He was making a five-minute piece for the district just to make them look good. It's a region that holds lots of foot dog races. And I said, hey, man, I got to get your phone number and your email. I figured the more ways I could contact him, the more likely it was I could keep a hold of him and make sure I got his footage. And he ended up being incredibly generous. I said, can you come over to our guest house? We were staying with some Team Canada, Team Sweden, some different folks at a big guest house. He came over that night and I said, look, I got to buy this off you. We don't have much money. Can I offer you €100? He said, look, I want to give it to you. You can give me the €100 and I'll come to the U.S. and spend it on a trip. But I want to give you guys this footage because after I'm done using it, it doesn't mean anything to me, but I know it means a lot to you. And when you get those kind of bumps, when somebody helps you out in that way on your mission, and all of a sudden you have really good footage, because that footage brings out the spiritual side of a 10-dog team, 12-dog team running in the Black Forest just off into the beautiful wilderness. It's very much what we know from Alaska. But I think people in the sprint world haven't communicated to the folks out there who might want to get in the sport that there's those moments available to them too. It's not all just, you know, all out, kind of up and down, done. That there are those profound moments where it's just you and your team hauling ass in this landscape. And drones capture that. They capture the depth of the crowd. They capture mass starts. And so that guy ended up being hired by the International Federation of Foot Dog Sports based on a relationship with him. And they flew him to Canada to get the Dryland World Championships. And then they flew him to Savala, Norway to get the European Championships 2016. And each time I gave him $100 as a donation, and he gave me the footage. And so you'll see all throughout Dog Power, when you see a killer shot like that, it's Max. And also he had a really nice gimbal set up. He's out of Switzerland, Germany, he lives on the border, and he has really nice equipment. So he gave us pretty much all the killer gimbal shots. We always traveled really, really light. And maybe that answers another question about what kind of gear we had. Jordan and I kind of realized if we show up with very small, compact equipment that the race marshals and the, you know, the officials won't make us stay out of the way, because we won't be in the way. We'll be in and out with our shots. We'll be close and then out of the way. We won't have a whole bunch of booms, big expensive stuff hanging all over the place. And that got us lots of access. You'll see in Dog Power, there's a lot of close-ups on incredibly happy, endorphin-filled dogs. Lots of slobber, lots of dirt, lots of mud to give the audience an idea that, man, there's no question there's this bliss going on here. And your second question, it's tough to get footage off a dog right now. There, GoPro does make a holder for the camera. Of course, it does bounce all over the place. We found success in asking mushers for their sled footage that they, when they strap a GoPro on the sled.
Right.
We used that 3 or 4 times. We cut to that. And, of course, most people have that. Just at this Waimea Film Festival on the Big Island, I talked to some guys who are, you know, river rafters and big animal explorer-type filmers. They work for BBC and National Geographic. There is more technology coming out there to have stabilizers that can strap on to animals. The problem with the sprint sled dog, as we all know, is they are hauling ass, right? They are in the 22 to 23-mile-an-hour range. And that's a lot of equipment to put on a dog that, you know, that you're trying to keep as little weight on as possible just so they can focus on their job. So we found success in being in front of a dog team with a snow machine and in Norway a couple times. Key players knew that that was going to be our need and set that up for us. They said, hey, next morning, guess what? We're going to go on the trail. We got permission. We got the machine, and you get to film our teams. And that really helps because you get that you really get that idea of the speed. But there's still some room in there, Robert, for more. I don't know what it's going to be. Maybe it's a drone that hovers right over the dog that is more quiet, you know, annoying drones.
Right.
Now maybe they can silence them or get some different propulsion mechanism in them where they can hover, or maybe they can GPS locate like 18 inches above the dog's head or 6 inches and just sort of hover there and not interfere with, you know, four blades or six blades, scare the hell out of the dog. That's maybe the breakthrough we're looking for.
Well, my next question to you, Cale, we're talking to Cale Casey. He is, I assume, the director, writer, producer, just about everything on a new movie called Dog Power. The website is dogpowermovie.com. Cale, you know that back in the day, they had mushing as a sort of an exposition sport in the Olympics, back in the late 30s, I guess, mid-30s or so. What do you think about that now? Now that you're involved with that, do you think that that could ever happen again? Because this truly is an international sport, and I don't see why it couldn't be possible.
Okay, great question. So I am Team USA's team leader for world championships the last couple of times, and have talked a lot about this with the Norwegians, who are really been driving the point the last two decades, ever since they had the 1994 Olympics in Lillehammer and Hamar. They thought that they would have a really good chance of getting a version of mushing into the Olympics. And the committee was looking at it. There were a few more exhibitions and demonstrations done. Even recently, a couple of years ago, there was one that the juniors did. We are part of Sport Accord, which is the international organization that the International Olympic Committee looks at to pick sports from. If you remember Sport Accord, that means you follow anti-doping rules, and you have a track record of that. Of course, the Olympics is looking at that. They're looking at also distribution. How many countries in the world could be competitive if the Olympics wanted to do the sport? I mean, you have to be spread over a certain number of continents. And here's the frustrating part, Robert. We all know this. All of a sudden, snowboarding becomes cool, and some goofy event like slopestyle, and it becomes an Olympic event overnight and has high ratings, and everybody's in love with it. And here's this sport that takes so much more dedication, so much more time, your own breeding, your own dedication to your dogs, your own figuring out everything, and yet you can't get a crack at being in front of the world stage, because as soon as we can do that, the sponsorship level will fly through the roof, and we'll have money involved in training and dog care and all those things. And we're just at a point where the hardest thing right now is to grow the sport, and that's one of my personal missions. It's not something I don't see myself ever competing in Olympics, but goddamn, I would love to see the juniors in a few years have at least a roadmap to say, hey, if I work really hard and get really good at this in my lifetime, I can represent my nation on the biggest stage in the world.
You know, I think it's possible, and it truly is international. You mentioned, Germany, Norway, Finland, Canada, U.S., of course. You know, mushing is very popular, in particular the dry land races in South Africa and Australia, New Zealand, parts of South America. It's everywhere. And I think that it truly is inspiring people when they see films like this, or they see coverage of sprint-type races, whatever that is, whether it's canicross or skijoring or the sprint mushing or whatever. It truly does inspire them to get out there and be active with their dog. And I think, at least to me, I'm a dog trainer by trade. If I can do anything for that relationship, I'm going to promote it. And I think that's what you're trying to do with your film. And I think that's what the sport's trying to do in general. Do you agree?
I do. I think the hard part, though, is we have two places we have to really give some ground. For one, people have to understand that doping control is really important. And I know when the World Championships came to Alaska, there was big resistance amongst the mushers of going through that scrutiny of being randomly selected. I get it. I was actually the only Team USA member selected for doping control. I thought it was for my dog, and they said, no, it's for you. And I had to pee in the cup and wait 3.5 weeks to see the results come back, clear.
Right.
And you worry the whole time. What if I took a supplement? What if something went down? And so people need to embrace the doping control, which is tough. The other thing we need to embrace is the Olympic Stadium concept. And so in Norway, the discussions with the IOC were, and they tried this in Holmenkollen in 2011, International Federation World Championship, had 6,000 spectators. They covered it on TV. There's a live TV audience of tens of thousands watching across Scandinavia. And it's the stadium concept that you force your team to loop through the stadium multiple times. And we all know that we'd much rather be on a one-way trail where you don't have to re-loop anything and right. just go out and do our, whether it be 1,000 miles to Nome, even better, or, you know, through the ONAC course or the, any distance course that you love, mid-distance, whatever it is, you don't have to bring the dogs back around. The Olympic model is what they're calling it, would be like a 4K loop. Mm-hmm. So you come back so the audience can see, oh, and there's number 7, and there's number 9, and then, oh, he passed or she passed or whatever, or the dogs are getting tired, or the other models that they want to see is some sort of transition. So, for example, in the combined racing of 1 and 2 dog sports, there's a transition where you drop your pulk, the pulk being the weird sled that the dog pulls between you and the dog. It's a Scandinavian style, like they used it on glaciers back in the day. We use it on Denali to haul gear, but it's a weird one-dog event where you drop that 7.5K in, and all kinds of things can go wrong when you're trying to unclip to that. And to the audience, that's exciting, because you came in with a lead, and now you're losing your lead, and oh, my God, his hands are frozen, and you can't unclip the poke, and the crowd's going wild. And the Olympic Committee sees that as something that we would have to embrace to get the crowd excited. And, you know, do we want to do that? Is that really what we're all about? And for distance, I don't know how they're going to, again, they manage the marathon somehow. They could probably manage the distance race, but the dogs are definitely worthy of the attention, I believe. And I know that everybody out there who's training right now for the big races, we just had the Kinnick last weekend, and people are getting ready for the 300 coming up and getting ready for a Quest and Iditarod. And World Championships in Canada starts opening ceremonies January 22nd in Halliburton in Ontario. We have a really robust Team USA showing up to compete against the world. People are worthy of it. Their dogs are worthy of it. But we are going to have to bend and twist if we want to see it in our lifetime.
You know, as you talk about that, Cale, I'm thinking about that scene in one of the newer Star Wars movies where they're doing the racing with the land cruisers or whatever, and the fans are going crazy and they're breaking down. It just reminds me of everything that you said. Have you seen that scene in that movie?
And the race officials, ironically, they love a little bit of gluttony and a little bit of people making mistakes.
Right.
Audiences want to see if you have all the skills it takes to get through an event. And that's both exciting and maddening, especially if you're the one who gets humiliated at the transition. And I've done a lot of filming of that. We filmed enough to make a feature-length movie. We just had to cut it down to 30 minutes because of budget and for film festivals.
Excellent.
If we have my way someday, I'd love to have a feature length. I've talked to some people about it. There's stories upon stories here. There's the agony of training your dog team and having an illness come in. My God, I mean, how many stories do you have? How many stories do your listeners have right now? Like that year where they had everything so aligned and then the dog team got loose one night or ran across the town or whatever and got lame or any of a number of things that can happen, usually kennel cough or something uncontrollable like that, where you're just like, God, my whole year just went up right now, and I can't race. And so, you know, the stories upon stories are waiting. I was lucky enough to find an era in the world where the sprint story hadn't been told. I certainly hope that somebody listening right now tries to out-tell my story with even better footage and a deeper message in some other, you know, other part. We definitely covered the adaptive side of the mushing world, and I think there's going to be a future of that, especially with the larger kennels and returning veterans, as they have been coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan with more and more limb loss injuries, that the dog teams that are able to bring them back into wholeness are going to be more valued by the public. And I think that'll be another way that the public sees larger kennels as being really, really important.
Excellent. Well, Cale, we are out of time. I highly appreciate you being on today. We just connected last night from a mutual Facebook friend, and I'm so happy that we were able to connect. What is next for you, real quick, and then how do folks get a copy of this movie? Is it available on your website? Tell us about that.
Sure, you bet. Folks can go to either dogpowermovie.com or they can go to welovedogpower.com. We have a name your price policy, so you can rent it for as little as $2 or own it for as little as $6 if you want to kick down more, we'll certainly use it towards what's next and paying off our debts. What's next for me is the film is on Banff World Tour. It's playing sold-out shows all across Canada and the U.S. right now. It just is going to Bozeman next couple of days, Fort Collins, Calgary. Me personally, I'm getting ramped up to be team leader for the World Championship starting on the 23rd. And then I'm getting all excited about the February races. I'm getting more into distance, getting to know the distance mushers and supporting them with dog gear and learning about who they are and what they're doing. So I'll be up in Alaska a bunch more, especially I'm curious to see how the junior Iditarod mushers do, and, of course, the big show. So any support that people want to kick down online, it goes right into what's next. And what's next is amplifying what we've already started.
Excellent. Cale Casey is our guest. He is the documentarian behind Dog Power, dogpowermovie.com. Cale, it's been a pleasure, and we'll talk again soon, okay?
Great. Thanks so much, Robert. Appreciate
Thank you. On behalf of my guest today, this is Robert Forto. We will see you guys next time.